Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Nina Simons about women in leadership, and we're going to be speaking with Dina Aquilina about community-supported agriculture. I'm delighted now to welcome David L. Witt. He's curator at the Academy for the Love of Learning, and he is guest curator of the exhibition Wild at Heart, Ernest Thompson Seton, which opens this coming Saturday, the 22nd of May, at the New Mexico History Museum. And there's also a reception on Sunday, the 23rd, from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk about this character who perhaps isn't as well known as some other naturalists who are famous here in New Mexico. Ernest Thompson Seton, conservationist, author, artist, co-founder of the Boy Scouts. He was born in 1860 in England. Where did his life go from there?
He was, his first years were spent in England, and then his family immigrated to Canada in 1866. So he grew up on the Canadian frontier in Ontario. And as an older teenager and young man, spent a lot of time in Manitoba, which is farther west. Learned a great deal about nature in that time because living on the frontier as much as he did, he was in very close contact with wild nature on a regular basis. Although he also spent part of his childhood in Toronto as well, where he got introduced to art.
And so he grew up, ended up in the United States, and there was this very important moment in his life where he was basically hired to kill wolves and did so, and then had a giant change of heart.
That is really the thrust of the show that we're doing at the New Mexico History Museum. Seton began making his living while he was still in Toronto and then moving to New York part-time as an illustrator. And he became the most important and most talented wildlife illustrator of his time. But in addition to that, he also spent a lot of time in Manitoba, and one of the things that he had done there was to trap wolves. He was a hunter, but really not a sport hunter. He collected specimens for museums, mostly birds, some mammals. But he got something of a reputation as a hunter, and so an acquaintance of his in 1893 asked him to make a trip to New Mexico and try out his wolf hunting skills on a group of wolves in what is now Union County that were causing considerable problems to ranchers there. So when he got there, the first thing he found was that the New Mexico gray wolves were different than the timber wolves of Canada, and he was unable to catch any of them.
Why was that?
They were too smart for him. He himself nearly gave up on it. The wolves had learned, had adapted to only hunt at night. Before that, wolves had hunted in the daytime. But when this country was taken over by people with rifles, the wolves changed their habits. So they became harder to catch. In addition to that, through a few generations of wolf hunting in New Mexico, the wolves began to learn the smell of poisons. So even a poison well hidden in a bloody carcass, the wolves could smell it and learn not to eat anything that was poisoned. The particular wolves that he was after also learned to avoid steel traps, which would be hidden in the ground. But the wolves would come along, find the traps, kick rocks onto the traps, and spring them.
Very smart doggies there.
They were actually rather brilliant at what they did. And Seton had not quite understood how intelligent they are, although he'd always understood them as being remarkable. But he began to learn that they were even more remarkable. One of the things that really impressed him was family loyalty. A wolf who did get trapped would be protected for as long as possible by other members of the pack, a kind of loyalty that Seton had not expected to see in wolves. But it was something that he saw here. After the poisons that he tried to use on them didn't work, he then resorted to the leg traps, spring leg traps. But he wasn't having much luck with those either, at least not a lot. Eventually, he would catch 6 wolves with traps, but he would have to work really hard to hide them and would have to develop strategies. Knowing that the wolves would find the traps, he would make some more obvious and then hope that the wolves stumbled into one that was less obvious.
And so he did catch some magnificent wolves, kill them, and then sort of turn around and say, what was I thinking?
When he got to wolf number 6, he planned on staying in New Mexico somewhat longer and going after more wolves. But when he got to the 6th one, he was unable to kill it. When the wolves are trapped, they can't move very much, but they still have a lot of fight in them. So when the trappers would come after the wolves, they'd be forced to shoot them. Nothing else they could do. But when he got to wolf number 6, he couldn't do it. He kept it alive, took it back to the ranch where he was working, and it died a few hours later, probably as a result of complications from the traps. But in his journal, when he wrote about it, he did something really remarkable, and he wrote this question of why. And he wrote it in large letters, capitalized, and bolded. And I realized that this was where I could, the takeoff point for creating this exhibition, because when Seton asked that, he was asking questions on a whole bunch of levels, starting with what made him even want to kill wolves. And in addition to that, and more importantly, what makes us as humans want to be destructive towards nature, towards wildlife and habitats? And as he was thinking about this, he realized he'd come upon something very important. So in November of 1894, he published the story of his wolf hunt in New Mexico, in which, in the form of a short story, but there was also natural history about wolves included in it. And in that story, unlike all the other hunting stories ever written, he made himself the villain and the wolf the hero. It's really the beginning of environmentalist literature.
And he was a prolific writer as well as artist.
He was. He went on to write something like 40 books and scores or perhaps hundreds of articles. Everything from short stories to contributions to scientific journals.
He was also influenced by his contact with Native American people, I guess in Canada more than in the United States.
Well, both, but starting with First Nations people in Canada, from whom he learned a lot about nature and learned it in a way that he could not have done in any academic institution at the time. Because the native peoples there had an inherent ecological view of nature, which was not the case. The word ecology was still pretty rare in the 1880s and even into the early 1900s. So Seton's training as a naturalist came in large part from native peoples who taught him about the interrelationship of plants and animals to their environment. And this was at a time when this way of thinking was not taught at any of our academic institutions.
I think it's really important to look at the difference between killing animals in order to survive, but also respecting them on the one hand, and killing animals because they are considered a natural resource for your own enrichment on the other.
Seton came to really dislike trophy hunting, that is, killing for the sake of killing. He was not against hunting for the sake of getting food for your family,
exactly.
For instance.
Yeah.
But the idea of, he had an inherent sense of fairness. He thought that the best way to go after game would be to use a bow and arrow or a black powder weapon, so that you had to get really close to it, and so that it put it on a more fair footing between the hunter and the hunted.
We're talking to David L. Witt, curator of the exhibition Wild at Heart, Ernest Thompson Seton. So here is a person who, and I think it's really interesting and important to look at people who are role models for specialization in more than one area. He was an incredible artist, really, on the level of Audubon. He was a naturalist. He was an outdoorsman. And he was really a scientist as well.
He was, and he was an innovator in a number of fields. He was really the first person to bring widespread popularity to the idea of wildlife conservation. He popularized it more than anyone else of his time, and which was very important. And he really put together what would later emerge as the land ethic with Otto Leopold in the 1940s. But Seton was writing about this much earlier. The other thing he did, which is very important, is that he felt that in order for us to change our attitude about nature, and in the 19th century our attitude towards nature was fairly brutal, it was just something to be destroyed and gotten out of the way. He had a very different view of wilderness, which would be more familiar to contemporary wilderness advocates, but it was not a very common attitude at the time. He understood that in order to change these attitudes, that he had to start with the nation's youth. So in 1902, he started, through a series of magazine articles and also summer camps, instruction in nature studies, Indian lore, as they called it back then, and crafts projects, a lot of which became the standard programming of summer camps that many of us grew up with, whether we were in scouts or church camps or other kinds of camps. But the programming that most of us, right into the present day, would have experienced at those summer camps was invented by Seton in 1902. He called his group the Woodcrafters, and it became very popular as a idea that spread throughout the Northeast. But the idea also reached another person by the name of Robert Baden Powell in England. Baden Powell took a lot of Seton's ideas and combined them with ideas of his own, and in 1908 invented an organization called the Boy Scouts. Within a couple of years, the Boy Scouts had gone worldwide. And Baden Powell got a lot of the credit for it, in fact, most of the credit for it, because he had coined the term. He was not quite as forthcoming in explaining that a lot of the ideas in scouting came from Ernest Thompson Seton, who was really the co-founder of the movement. It's estimated that in the last century, something over 350 million young people have been involved with scouting worldwide. And it all came from this first idea that Seton had in 1902.
And how did he envision this contact with nature for the little, I guess it was eventually girls and boys, but at that point, boys?
Yeah, what he wanted to do is get kids outside. He thought that outdoor recreation was essential. And while you have them outside anyway, you can have adults and also older children who are trained to do so teach younger ones about nature. I was part of this system myself in the 60s when I worked at summer camps and taught nature merit badges. It was exactly the kind of thing that Seton wanted us to do. Not that I'd ever heard of Seton back then, but the idea of kids working with kids and adults working with kids of all ages, not telling them what to do so much, but giving them guidance and giving them opportunities. Seton thought that if we had the opportunity to get out in nature, to enjoy camping, hiking, fishing and hunting for that matter, all kinds of outdoor pursuits, that as we got older, and it's starting with that first generation that he worked with in 1902, that as kids became adults, they would continue to want to have that contact with nature, and eventually they would become active in trying to preserve our wild heritage.
When you look at the Boy Scouts today, do they carry in a strong part Seton's ethic and way of working?
Yeah, no doubt about it. Both Baden Powell, ideas from Baden Powell and from Seton are still very much working within scouting organizations worldwide. But the nature, contact with nature part of it, this was what Seton gave to scouting, and of course is for me the really the most important part.
So he eventually landed in New Mexico. Tell us about his work and life here.
So he never forgot New Mexico. After that first period, he arrived originally in October of 1893, left in February of 1894, and then didn't come back again until about 1915, but then became a regular visitor to New Mexico after that. By about 1927, he decided he wanted to live here, and so he and his second wife, Julia, began looking for property in the Santa Fe area in 27, at the very end of the decade, about December of 1929, they found property that they really liked. By early 1930, they purchased it, and at the very center of that property is the neighborhood that's now known as Seton Village.
And he built basically a castle.
He built a castle for himself. And it was actually the second, well, it's actually the third castle he had built for himself, partly because he'd had a not very good relationship with his father. And his father had always dreamed of building a castle for himself and never was able to manage it. And so I think partly as an ironic gesture towards his own father, Seton built a series of castles. Anyway, the last of them was on the hill, which is at the east end of Seton Village. He built it throughout the 1930s. And it was a stone masonry building, not particularly well constructed, but rather interesting in style, very much his own. He designed it. It doesn't really follow any particular architecture model that I know of. The building was never really winterized, so they abandoned it during the winter. It was too cold, like castles often are. But he lived there and eventually died there. He was his last few months was very sick, and he was in a hospital here in town. And when they said, we can't do anything for him, they sent him back to the castle where he spent his last days.
We're talking to David L. Witt about the exhibition Wild at Heart, Ernest Thompson Seton, which is opening at the New Mexico History Museum this weekend. So this site, this castle, which actually burned down a few years ago, what's it all about now? What's happening there?
I should say that the place where he sited the castle is a very strong place. Probably, I'm sure that he would have thought of it as a power place, because it's on one of the southernmost spurs of the entire Rocky Mountain chain. That's why he selected that spot. He built this stone building on it, and it's a very special place, among other things. The views are quite spectacular from there. After he left, his family tried to take care of it over the years, but the building was a bit of a mess because it wasn't constructed all that well to begin with. Eventually, the building, or what remained of it anyway, was sold to the Academy for the Love of Learning.
Of which you are the curator.
Of which I'm the curator. The Academy is an organization that works in transformational education and runs a number of different projects in leadership, work with teacher renewal, art projects, consulting with other nonprofit organizations on a variety of issues. They acquired in 2003 Seton Castle and some surrounding property for their headquarters. So one of the things that the Academy did was to start a renovation of the castle itself to return it to its appearance of the late 1930s, when it was really at its height. During the construction, there was an accident of unknown origin, but it resulted in a massive fire which completely destroyed the building.
Amazing.
I was there watching it by chance.
Yeah.
And it just it took off. Nobody knew why. The building was something like 8,000 square feet, and within 2 or 3 minutes, it was completely engulfed in flame. So there was no saving it. But the castle, although in its previous incarnation is gone, is being preserved. We're going to keep the original footprint of the building and the main rooms on the first floor, and we are going to reinterpret it as a contemplative garden and outdoor gathering space. There will be lots of native plants there. I'm an amateur botanist, and so this appeals to me a great deal.
Nice.
And it will be a very special place, a quiet place, and I think Seton would be pleased that we will have taken his building and honored it by maintaining as much of it as we can, but also giving it a new life as a special place for visitors.
And the love of learning itself is something that surely would have appealed to him.
Yes, oh, very much. Seton thought education was really the key to everything, and the academy, of course, believes exactly the same thing. So it's a very good match between Seton's philosophy and that of the academy.
So this exhibition, Wild at Heart, that's opening this weekend, what are the actual objects in the show?
So what we will see in the exhibition is all of the things that we've talked about. It's a journey through Seton's life, beginning with his encounter with the New Mexico wolves and how he came to the realization that wolves are, in fact, all wildlife, are much like us. Not different in kind, but only different by degree, which was a radical concept for 1894. So we will enter the exhibition, find out a little bit about that, and then follow through on the rest of his life. But it is well illustrated with original works of art that he did, drawings and paintings, and artifacts related to his life. Everything from a token they gave him as a identification badge at the Royal Academy in London when he was an art student, when still a teenager, a microscope that he had that he used in his science work, and other such items like that.
So there's many, many activities surrounding this exhibition, both this weekend and in the weeks and months to come. It's a long-running exhibition. But I want to let people know that this Saturday, the 22nd of May, it's open during the regular museum hours.
Well, from 12 to 5.
From 12 to 5. And then on Sunday, there will be a wolf, an actual wolf, a timber wolf ambassador from the Wild Spirit Wolf Sanctuary from noon to 4.
Yes, and that was important to me right from the beginning when I was first talking about the exhibition with the wonderful staff at the History Museum who have done an extraordinary job in putting this together.
They are so awesome. This museum is incredible.
This is a fantastic museum. It's the most fun I've ever had putting together an exhibition. I've been doing this for quite a few decades, actually. But one of the things I asked for is that we bring wolves to the exhibition at the opening, and administrators being paid to be somewhat cautious. We're not certain if that was a good idea or not, but we found this organization in the western part of the state that provides a sanctuary for wolves and wolf dogs, and one of the things they do is education about wolves, and so they go to various events around the state and bring wolf ambassadors with them, and then let people meet the wolf and explain the natural history of wolves. I think it'll be really fascinating.
And there's also going to be a special program about the wolf.
Yes, for anyone who would like to meet our wolf ambassador, there will be a special program with the wolf from 1:30 to 2. And the wolf will be there all day, but his handlers will be doing talking for him during that time and telling everybody who shows up all about wolves.
Excellent. David L. Witt is curator at the Academy for the Love of Learning, which is on the web at aloveoflearning.org. And he is the curator of the exhibition Wild at Heart, Ernest Thompson Seton, which once again opens at the New Mexico History Museum this weekend. And for more information, you can go to nmhistorymuseum.org. And there's a wonderful catalog, which is richly illustrated and with wonderful text. And highly recommended. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm happy now to welcome Nina Simons. She's the co-founder of Bioneers, and she will be co-facilitating a retreat called Cultivating Women's Leadership. It's happening for about a week this coming July. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
So, women's leadership. What is special about women's leadership?
Well, I have a rather controversial opinion about this, which is that I think that women are particularly well-equipped to respond to the leadership calls of this particular time on Earth. I think that that's due to a very complex combination of factors having to do with both nature and nurture. So both how we're biologically different than men, and also how our culture and our cultural legacy has actually trained us to be relationally attuned in certain ways. In some ways, I think that this moment is really ripe for women's leadership, and we happen to be fortunate enough to live at a time when we have a great deal more opportunity in this country than we've probably ever had before. But also, I think that women and men share an opportunity to redefine leadership. And what I mean by that is that the model that we've inherited tends to be one that most women I know to don't aspire to.
What does that model look like that we've inherited?
Well, I think our inherited model of leadership is a solo model. I think that it tends to be self-isolating. It tends to include self-sacrifice. And it tends to involve leadership through aggression or domination.
And so I think, the kind of alpha baboon style.
Well, it's certainly a sort of, quote, masculine model. And I use the quotes because I don't believe that that's the authentic masculine or the healthy masculine. But I do think that's the model that we've grown up seeing.
And so what does the feminine or female model of leadership, as it's probably being cultivated in, the last century or so, what does that look like?
Well, rather than talk about a female model, I would prefer to go for an integrated model, because the leadership that I want really gives me an opportunity to draw from the full range of human capacities at any moment, so that regardless of whether I happen to be in a women's body or a man's body, I have this range of capabilities to select from. So I think that's part of the leadership model that we are co-creating, but I also think that women are particularly leading right now in defining a kind of leadership that is principally sourced from what we care most deeply about, from the heart. So in a sense, it's led from the heart rather than the mind. It integrates our intellect, if we're lucky, as well as our physical capacity and our intuition. But I think one of our greatest sources of strength is our passion and what we really, what we care most deeply about, and therefore what we're most motivated to defend and protect and transform.
One of the insights that I had as a young adult getting out of college and going into the world was that the separation between heart and mind, or between intellect and emotions, was a false one in the first place, and that if you tried to do things from your head, it just didn't work very well, but if you tried to do things from a kind of more integrated place, it would engage your kind of ethical and moral and personal and passionate and intellectual sensibilities kind of all at the same time.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And for me, what you're describing, it really speaks to a lot of what motivated me to co-found Bioneers 20 years ago in the first place, was the recognition that we live in a culture that actually has us habituated to a lot of false separations.
Right.
And that the more we can dissolve those false separations, actually the more congruent and joyful and purposeful life we can live.
So, again, when you are leading an organization, there you are, co-founder of Bioneers, and you have all sorts of challenges that you've been facing for, year after year, running an organization isn't easy. What does the new paradigm of leadership on the ground, use specific examples, look like?
Well, I think it involves a balance of speaking and listening. To be specific, I think that the old model of leadership was more about thinking we know the answers and then imposing them on either an organization or the world. And I think the new model involves at least equal parts, if not perhaps even more listening than speaking. So I think that it's a conscious dance between being focused and intentional in our actions and also being receptive and experiential and learning from what works and what doesn't work. So you know, both with Bioneers and with Cultivating Women's Leadership. Well, with Cultivating Women's Leadership specifically, we have a five-day retreat where I have a colleague, Toby Hertzlick, who many folks in Santa Fe may have encountered. She's been in town a long time and done a lot of leadership work and also facilitation work. And we've got a program we've developed, but we're prepared to change it on a dime, depending on what comes up in the moment from the women who are there. And we listen very, very closely for the feedback and evaluation input that we get at the end of every training. And so we are constantly fine-tuning and constantly adjusting. And I think that's what makes it really alive. And I think Bioneers is similar.
When you do these workshops, what kinds of issues are people bringing? What kind of questions are people bringing to this question of cultivating women's leadership?
Well, I think people bring a whole host of questions. And, you know, part of what we put out and what attracts women to want to take the training is that we are clear in saying part of our purpose is to help every woman who comes to clarify her own sense of purpose or assignment or calling in the world. Another part of our purpose is to attract diverse women, diverse across age and ethnicity and issue area, so that we can all exercise our capacity to connect across differences, because that's another false separation that our culture really imposes.
Right.
So everybody comes with big questions about leadership. When we first started offering the training, women would call us and they'd say, well, I'd love to go in deep with a group of juicy, committed, smart women, but I'm not so sure about this leadership thing. And so we realized, you know, one of the first things we do is to really explore what does leadership mean and what are both our dreams and our fears about women moving more into leadership.
Well, what does leadership mean?
Well, I think leadership means the capacity to motivate others to care about the issues that you see as being really important to transform in the world. And so that can have many, many different shapes. I mean, I think part of this new model of leadership is that it's as diverse as the people who practice it. So there are leaders who are artists, and there are leaders who are organizers, and there are leaders who are community builders, and leaders who are parents and moms and families, you know, and teachers and health practitioners. So I think it's really a question of, you know, for me, leadership is about staying connected to your inner voice, to your full host of information, which, as you were saying earlier, really includes the wisdom of our bodies, minds, hearts, and spirits, integrated in a solid, intentional way, and then acting from a sense of purpose.
What are some of the fears that come up, particularly for women?
Well, there are many. I think, you know, some of the obvious fears are of being a target, of women's competition, of being labeled with the B word. You know, as soon as we're assertive, we have a whole host of
beautiful, bright, brilliant
societal expectations, like a female dog, you know. And so we all have a fear. We all want to be liked on some level. And I think we all have fears of becoming targets, and for a lot of good reasons.
So when people come in with various fears about being labeled or about competition and so on, and there they are in a group of other women, you know, not too big a group, but, you know, bigger than you probably have in your daily life or your family, what do you do? Like, what does it look like?
Well, a lot of what we do is that we feel that part of what strengthens women is to look at our shadow material. So that involves really facing what are the fears that we have, what is some of the conditioning that we have, what are the blind spots that we may have as women who are gaining the benefit of having white skin in the world, in a world that is racially biased. You know, what are the challenges that women of color are facing in this culture? So we create a very safe space to actually talk about those things. And part of what we really believe is that it's only by unearthing and really exploring and really accepting the shadow material that we can actually walk forward in a whole and integrated way. So we explore the fears. We explore them together. And a lot of what we find as women is that often, you know, one of our purposes in doing this training is to offer the women who come a really deep experience in their bodies of what it's like to be in a group of 20 women who are authentically and purposefully aligned on behalf of each other's best emergence. And few, if any, of us have had that experience. And it's quite life-changing, I think, when you do have it. So a lot of what we do is really create the conditions for all that to be able to happen. And some of it's through hearing each other's stories. Some of it's through practicing how we show up in the world and practicing particular skills and practices having to do with facing controversy or difficult conversations or assessing our life balance. You know, so we practice and we work through a whole lot of literal practical tools that we can all use both for ourselves and each other, and that we can use beyond the retreat going forward, because part of our premise is really that leadership is a lifelong process, and I hope I'm cultivating my own until the day I die.
I think one of the things that's difficult in the world in which we live, the United States has a kind of... we're imposing our will on the rest of the world attitude, and there that permeates the sort of corporate culture of many of our larger corporations, certainly not the more progressive ones. But when you have this very kind of old world, call it male-dominated, call it patriarchal and perhaps patronizing corporate and political structure, and then women go on a women's leadership retreat. You know, how do you infiltrate this whole other world, which is the world that really needs to be influenced by a more, what would you call it, kind of systemic, ecosystem-oriented attitude?
Well, that's a great question, and I actually think that we are alive at a very rare moment of opportunity where those things are in the process of changing already. And I think part of the answer that we really look at is that we can't do it alone. We need each other. And actually, one of the big ahas for me that really led to doing this work was the recognition that the more we can create ongoing, meaningful connections in relationships that I call mutual mentorship with other women, regardless of different ages, different ethnicities, doesn't matter. We all have a lot to learn from each other. Right? The more that we can do that, the more we can strengthen our own capacity to take the stands and make the changes that are needed. Because I think, you know, it's a both-and world. On the one hand, yes, all those biases exist and they're hard to get through. And at the same time, there's more receptivity. I'm sure you've seen, Mary Charlotte, like there were a slew of articles about how the economic meltdown on Wall Street might not have happened if there had been more women leaders on Wall Street.
No doubt. I have a cousin who worked for AIG, and after the big meltdown, he quit. And he came through Santa Fe on his motorcycle and was telling us what this culture was like inside of that company. And it was so patriarchal. And so, I mean, his job was trying to get people to listen to each other on a very simple level. That was his job, and it was incredibly difficult.
I bet.
And I thought, you know, I wish they had broken up those companies, because a new model really needs to come into being.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the notion that they were too big to fail is really a fallacy, and in fact, they were too big not to fail, you know. So I'm with you. But I think, you know, it's a curious moment, because it's a glass half full and glass half empty moment, and there's no mathematical difference except in how we orient ourselves and in recognizing that there are tremendous opportunities to make change right now.
So the workshop, Cultivating Women's Leadership, is happening here in northern New Mexico from July 19th to 24th. And for people who are interested in it, they can write an email to women@bioneers.org or call 505-986-0366, extension 129, or just Google Bioneers and you'll find it. And the deadline for applications is the 7th of June. There's some scholarship money available. You're encouraging particularly women of color, but any women to apply to this.
We're encouraging women who really care deeply about making changes in themselves and the world, because really our premise is that in order to change the world, we have to change ourselves first. And so we are very much encouraging women of color, women of any ethnicity, women of any age who are really lit up about making change.
And you've
apply.
Had many ages of women,
from 19 to 70s.
Yeah.
Yep, yep. So we embrace a wide span, and in fact, we want as much of every kind of diverse women there as we can get.
Nina Simons is co-founder of Bioneers and co-facilitator of the Cultivating Women's Leadership Training. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm happy now to welcome Dina Aquilina. She is the general manager of Beneficial Farms CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
So community supported agriculture is really making a name for itself. It's been around for a while. I mean, this is something people have been doing for, what, a decade or so?
Probably a couple. It started in New England, I think, in the 80s.
And what is it? How does it work?
Well, you prepay, basically, and to give the farmers a little something to work with financially, and then you share in the harvest when harvest time comes around, which is pretty much all year round, depending on where you live.
So I would prepay a certain amount, and then starting at the time of year when things are growing, you show up in a place and you bring home a big bag of vegetables and fruits.
Yes, and we are now year-round.
Is that right?
Because we're regional. So we work with 40 different farms in New Mexico, Colorado, Texas. And so during the winter, we do things like root crops and dried beans and quinoa from Colorado, honey, juice, and cheese made from local milk.
So it's not just fruits and vegetables.
It's not. It expands a lot more in the wintertime in terms of what our members get.
So what is the advantage of it over going to a store and just buying their vegetables and fruits there?
Well, one of the things is that it's a surprise every week. And that works for some people. An ideal CSA member loves to cook and loves to be adventurous and likes to eat with the seasons of where they live. And it cuts down on your time spent in the car and your time running around shopping in different places, because you pick up your bag of food on Thursday and then you know what you need to fill in maybe at the farmer's market. It's not a substitute for the farmer's market. I think it's an addition to it for those of us who are addicted to going to the farmer's market.
Right, right.
And we also support some of the same farmers who sell here.
So it's basically for those who, like me, who don't always get up early on Saturdays, it's a way of getting your vegetables.
Yes.
Uh-huh. From somewhere else.
Yes.
This particular farm, Beneficial Farms, are they an all-organic farm, or what's it like?
We work with 40 different farms,
and
they're not all certified organic, but they are all chemical-free. A lot of farmers, it's a lot of paperwork and hassle to get certified organic, and so some of them don't, although that's what they actually do. They just don't have the certification. So all of our farmers don't use chemical fertilizer or chemical pesticides, so it's all chemical-free.
Do you have people who work with any kinds of meat or poultry?
Yes, we do. And we have organic meat. We have beef and pork and chicken at this time. And we also have an egg option where you can get a dozen eggs every week if you want, or less often than that. And the thing that we're really excited about right now is we've just worked with some software developers in California who quit their jobs and started to form CSA online services. And so now people can sign up online, and in a couple of weeks they'll be able to buy extras online as well, because we do a lot of extras. In addition to the weekly share, you can order honey and cheese and meat, pickles, eggs, lots of different value-added items like that in addition to the regular fruit and vegetable share every week.
Wait, the regular fruit and vegetable share of your week that you get if you just sign up to do CSA would feed a family of 1, 10, 4?
It depends on how you eat. If you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, one person can do a share. They can also, depending on how you eat, do a family, of a mom and dad and a couple of kids.
What is your favorite thing about doing this? How long have you been doing it yourself?
Well, I started in the early 90s when Steve first started this CSA. And I like the surprise. I like that part of it. I like not having to run around a lot to have, these surprises. We're having a vegetable in our in our distribution this week that I've never heard of. It's called scorzonera.
That sounds nice and Italian to me.
And it's a root vegetable we're getting from Teague and Cosma Channing from Las Trampas, New Mexico. And I look forward to this new vegetable that I've never heard of.
Amazing. What do you do if you don't like, if you hate beets or if there's some vegetable? Can you exclude any one vegetable or fruit?
What we do is we have an exchange table at our distributions. And we prime it with a few different items. So you can exchange what you don't like for whatever's on the exchange table.
And vegetables grow, I mean, people are making, people are growing arugula and other vegetables and stuff all year round. What about fruits? Let's talk about the fruits that are available.
Yes, people can't really grow some of the fruits that we provide. We have one of our farms is Shiraz Winery down in La Luz, New Mexico, and so they provide us pomegranates. We had pomegranates last year for probably 4 or 5 weeks during the summer. We get figs from them and other things that don't grow in northern New Mexico. We work with an organic farm in Texas, and we had grapefruits during the winter several times. And right now, when there's no fruit in northern New Mexico of any sort, we have fair trade organic bananas from Ecuador.
So you really are working not just with local or regional farms. You're working with farms from all over the place.
Well, I say that we stretch the edges of our region.
To Ecuador?
Yes, when we need to. When there's no fruit available here, we always have at least one fruit in the distribution every week, and sometimes two and three.
And if it's fair trade, that's nice to know.
Yes.
That means that the people who grow them are not getting completely and totally shafted by the fruit growers.
That's right. And that's why the only way we would go out of our region would be for something that was fair trade.
Would you say that by participating and getting your vegetables and fruits through CSA that you do definitely reduce your carbon footprint?
Well, I think so, because you're not driving all around, you know, trying to buy things from different places. You have that one trip that you've made, and then you know what you need to add to that.
And the fruit is coming from, I mean, the tricky part is that where the fruits and vegetables and other products are coming from.
And we're generally hitching a ride on another truck that's already coming, so we're using systems that are already in place. So we're not sending a truck to do this. It's using systems that are already there.
What else should people know about community-supported agriculture?
Well, it's very fresh. I mean, it's incredibly fresh.
Are the vegetables tastier than?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm sure they are tastier than stuff that you get in the supermarket that's been sitting around for a few weeks. In terms of the freshness, it's really amazing, and it's really beautiful. The food is really beautiful. Last week, we had these Michele Choy from Taos Pueblo that were 2.5 feet long.
What's
it's
that?
It's a form of bok choy, and they were massive. They were huge.
Has it changed the way you cook?
It stretches you. And we have a blog, and so we have recipes every week for what we're providing. And if we have a new food, what we call a new food or a unique food, such as a tole or quinoa, we will have a little flyer for members that has recipes and explains this new food to them.
Is there anything like a trial membership if you want to just kind of see how it works in your life?
Yes, with our new system online, you can join up and try us out for a month, for 4 weeks, and see how things go.
Have you ever gotten into a position where you're just kind of like buying things and then end up composting, or do you find that you really use it?
I really use it. And one of the strategies that works well in the summer, particularly when there's a real abundance of things, is to start to freeze. And I make a lot of soups and stews and do it that way so that during the winter I can still eat locally.
Dina Aquilina is the general manager of Beneficial Farms Community Supported Agriculture. You can find them on the web at beneficialfarm.com. And you can also call 505-470-4000. 1969. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month Dave Holland in a support role with other jazz groups. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.